580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, June 14th, 2009, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. The news has been buzzing for the last few weeks with right-wing assassinations of a doctor in Kansas, an invasion of the Holocaust Museum, and a murder there by a self-professed racist, white supremacist, anti-Semite, and Nazi. What role does the right-wing news media and talk radio play in this process? Well, we're very fortunate today to have one of the real experts on that subject. David Nyrat will be joining us live on the phone for the full hour to discuss his new book and to talk about what's going on with the far right and right-wing radio. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
The volume is getting louder in the fight for more local community radio. Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit upheld a Federal Communications Commission ruling that protects low-power FM stations from encroachment when a full-power station tries to move into the same airwaves being used by a low-power one. Parul Desai, vice president of the Media Access Project, who represented the Prometheus Radio Project in the case, explains that low-power FM stations, or LPFMs, have always had secondary status to full-power stations.
So if a full-power station wants to move into a community where a LPFM already exists, the LPFM is required to move to make room for the full-power station so the full-power station doesn't suffer from any interference.
This means that LPFMs have only two options, move or get off the air. But options for where to move are limited. In December of 2007, the FCC passed a rulemaking that would allow LPFMs to relocate to a nearby empty channel where LPFMs hadn't been allowed, a move which prompted the National Association of Broadcasters, known as the NAB, to sue the FCC.
Last week, the court finally decided the case between the NAB and the FCC, and the D.C. Circuit found that the FCC correctly interpreted the statute and so dismissed the NAB's petition.
And this week, the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Communications Technology and the Internet held a hearing on the Local Community Radio Act, a bill that would expand the number of LPFM radio stations across the country. Representative Michael Doyle of Pennsylvania called on Congress to pass the legislation and end inconsistent rules that prevent new community-oriented LPFM stations from using the so-called third adjacent channel, the spot three clicks on the dial away from an existing station. While LPFMs have been banned, translators that repeat commercial radio signals have been allowed to broadcast.
What we call Rose by any other name would smell as sweet, but when it comes to FCC and the big broadcasters, this name is critical. Translators that serve the interest of big broadcasters work just fine on these third adjacent channels, and there's no complaints and no issues about interference. I just hope once and for all we can sort of eliminate this double talk that's been taking place for years.
Cheryl Lianza of the United Church of Christ, which advocates for LPFM, testified that this is not about issues of interference, but about incumbents protecting their territory.
Incumbents do not have a sterling track record when it comes to technical questions about new entrants. Whether it was the AM radio broadcasters trying to keep out that newfangled FM service in the 1930s, or it was Ma Bell telling you that it was absolutely impossible for you to buy a telephone in a store and hook it up to the network without causing the entire network to fall down, incumbents protect their territory, and this situation is no different.
Andrew Emmett, a high school senior in Knoxville, Tennessee, was looking on the internet for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered-related sites. He was trying to research scholarship money. But he discovered that LGBT websites were being blocked by his school system. So, along with two other students and a librarian, he went to the American Civil Liberties Union and filed a lawsuit. The schools in Knox County and more than 100 other Tennessee school districts, including metropolitan Nashville, have been using internet filtering software provided by Education Networks of America to block some LGBT sites. Catherine Crump of the ACLU is a lead attorney on the case.
It was impossible to access the websites of civil rights organizations advocating the fair treatment of gays and lesbians, but it was possible to access websites suggesting that people could change their sexuality through prayer.
The ACLU calls this type of blocking, quote, viewpoint discrimination, which allows access to one side of the debate while forbidding access to the other side of the debate.
Schools teach students the wrong lessons when they react to speech that they don't necessarily support by blocking access to that speech. We live in a democratic society where there's supposed to be a free exchange of ideas, especially about important political questions, and to simply block access to one side of a debate is out of step with that tradition.
Within a few weeks of filing the lawsuit, the Tennessee schools unblocked the sites. And in a surprise move, several Indiana schools that also use Education Networks of America to filter their networks also unblocked LGBT sites.
The ACLU is just really pleased that our clients are going to be able to have access to these websites when they go back to school. It's just nice that the schools, you know, although it may have taken a little encouragement, have decided to do the right thing and to unblock these websites. So this is a real success and a great victory from our point of view.
Although they are happy with the outcome and hope that the schools will continue to allow access to the LGBT sites, the ACLU has not withdrawn the lawsuit. They are waiting for an agreement in writing from the school district that they will not reblock the site. Crump hopes the students will contact the ACLU if they discover that their schools are blocking websites, too.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, June 14, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, a lovely summer's day. Our guest today could not be more timely, nor could the book he has written be more timely. Our guest is David Nywert. His book, The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, just released last month and is now shooting up the bestseller list. It's gotten phenomenal reviews. So we're very privileged to welcome him to our program today. David?
Hi, Bob. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you. And I really appreciate your willingness to be on our program on such short notice. And it's an honor to have you here. I have been admiring your work for some time.
Well, and might add that's a mutual admiration society.
Well, that's the only way you get on my show.
Yeah.
No, just kidding. You know, the last couple of weeks, I think, have drawn attention to a phenomenon you've been tracking for 20 years, if not, you know, 15 or 20 years, which is the radicalization of the political right in this country. And, you know, maybe before we go into the current events, the George Tiller murder, the Holocaust Museum, and a variety of other episodes that have taken place that have sort of gotten everyone's attention in the past few weeks, talk a little bit, if you would, about the antecedents to the moment we're in today. I mean, you started looking at the far right, I think, in the 80s. You're from Montana, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, what was your experience going back to the 80s going forward?
Well, actually, I was—I grew up in Idaho and was working in northern Idaho in the Panhandle area in the late 70s. I was the editor of the little paper there in Sandpoint when I was 21, and this was the period when the Aryan Nations folks were moving in up there, and we actually made a conscious decision not to cover them at the time, because we thought, well, we just don't want to give them the free publicity. That's what they want, and we just don't want to encourage that sort of thing. And, of course, in a couple of years, they gave us absolutely no choice in the matter. We had to be covering them because they were responsible for a spate of hate crimes in the region, as well as the order and its rampage in 1984. You know, I used to get letters to the editor from Robert Matthews, the leader of the order, and it was something else anyway. And he even called me on the phone once and asked, wanted to know why I wasn't writing his letters. But, you know, so I've been around this stuff for a long time. When I started freelancing seriously in 1992 or 3, actually it was 93 that I started. And I was looking around for subjects to write about, and at the time I was primarily an environmental reporter, but I was familiar with this milieu, and a friend of mine showed me some militia material, and I thought, well, we need to be paying attention to this because I understood how problematic they were. And by 1995, the coverage kind of took on a life of its own, especially after Oklahoma City, and I realized that I needed to deal with it on a much more serious level than I had been. And since then, I've tried to make writing about right-wing domestic terrorism and extremism sort of my beat. When I left MSNBC in late 2000, I wrote a piece for them, but at the same time, I was ready for a change in my career, so I became a stay-at-home father and started blogging about it on the side because it was a way of me to be able to publish the information that I had without having to fight with editors who were becoming increasingly difficult to sell on the stories. And I just always knew that this was going to be a story that somebody needed to be staying on, so I did.
What are the people that you've dealt with over the last 15 years who are on the far right, the racist right, the violent right, the right, the extra legal right, I guess is another way to put it. What are they like? And I say this assuming that most of my listeners, like myself, don't have a lot of contact with these folks.
Right. Well, actually, they probably do and just don't know it. I mean, the reality is that most of these people seem perfectly normal. I mean, if you go to a militia meeting back in the 90s, you know, they're just most of the people that go to these things, as with Aryan Congresses, for that matter, back in the 80s when I would go to an Aryan Congress, you know, you'd start to talk to people and kind of attendees. And for the most part, they're pretty normal-seeming people. Now you start digging a little beneath the surface, of course, you realize that they have these radical beliefs. But, you know, for the most part, most of these people pay their taxes, live in neighborhoods, go to PTA meetings and that sort of thing, and pretty much blend in with the rest of the scenery. They're not, it's not quite so the stereotype that we have of militia members as, you know, bellicose guys with big round bellies and beer guts and barely able to get themselves off their chase lounges, let alone crawl through the brush. But
that sounds like a good description of me.
Well, that's kind of the stereotype that developed, and it's not necessarily very accurate. But they did all kind of fit a sort of psychological profile. They were all what I would call exemplary dualists. That is, they had a very extreme black and white view of the world. They all saw themselves as heroic people who they helped to rescue society. But they just basically exhibited the sort of classic psychological profile of what Eric Erickson called the totalist mindset, or that is, people who avidly participate in sort of an authoritarian / totalitarian society. And, you know, that this is what the sort of world that they want to construct for themselves. They want somebody who is a strong authoritarian leader. And this is, so it becomes part of the mindset. And it always used to be that I could see a very strong difference between the people who I would go to in these meetings, militia meetings back in the 90s. It was always pretty easy to differentiate between them and mainstream conservatives. There's a fairly bright line. Generally speaking, there was none of the paranoia. You know, if you look at a mainstream conservative versus one of these people, you would see that they didn't have the paranoia, they didn't have the sort of conspiracist worldview. They weren't inclined to be nearly as racially incendiary and bigoted, and you know, most of the sort of traits that you often see on the paranoid right. And I can't say that that's true anymore. I think it's much harder to distinguish between them. Mainstream conservatives, especially people who call themselves movement conservatives, increasingly to me resemble and the sort of folks that I would meet in patriot movements back in the 1990s.
And if I can interrupt you here,
sure.
David Nyrat, the point you're making right here gets really to the theme of your new book, The Eliminations, which is the crucial role of mainstream commercial talk radio, but I also assume you mean cable TV.
Cable TV, as well as I think we should talk about, you know, just people who are in positions of authority, like politicians and religious leaders as well, and spreading this kind of stuff.
So it sort of legitimized this far-right politics in the eyes of the not far-right?
Yeah, yeah. What's been happening is that a lot of people on the mainstream right, particularly these talk show hosts, as they try to push the envelope, which is what they always have to do, is to sort of garner their ratings and keep their ratings out there on the edge and to stay on their edge. Well, eventually they started pushing this envelope well over into the territories that have long been tread by the far right, to the point now that you know, they basically, the agenda movement conservatives, particularly the anti-immigrant nativism and the sort of xenophobia about gays and lesbians and you know, a lot of other aspects, it's virtually indistinguishable from what David Duke ran on back in the late 80s. This was his agenda back then. And it's just been terrifying to watch mainstream conservatism just get dragged so far to the right. And, of course, it's dragged the whole country to the right with it. But a lot of the reality, or what's happened, is that people, these talk show hosts, in order to push the envelope, are constantly reaching for their grab bag, from ideas and memes and talking points and fake facts that originate on the far right. And they take these ideas and they sort of repackage them and buff them up and, you know, clean off the overt racism and anti-Semitism that underlies their worldview. And they transmit it out there for mainstream consumption. A lot of this we saw in the 90s going on during the Clinton impeachment, because I was seeing all of these bizarre talking points about Bill Clinton that I originally heard at militia meetings back in 93 and 94, being trotted out for mainstream consumption by people like Babe Buchanan and Ann Coulter in 1998 on MSNBC, where I was working at the time. And it was kind of astonishing to me to watch this happen. But it was also, you could clearly see the sort of mechanism of what Chip Berlay calls the transmission belt, this is how radical ideas work their way into the mainstream. And it was very clearly happening then, and it very clearly happened in the last 8 years as well.
David Nyward, our guest today, you've been listening to right now on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL-AM 580. We're coming to you live today, so please do feel free to call in with questions or comments. David Nyward is the author of the brand new book, Shooting Up the Bestseller List, The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, a book that could not be more timely in view of the events of the past 2 or 3 weeks. The number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I assume for doing the research for this book, David Nyward, you had to listen to and watch and consume a good deal of the hate talk or the right-wing media. And I imagine you're a bit of a connoisseur of it at this point. Well, I ask that because I watch it periodically and listen periodically, just sort of right, out of interest to know what's going on. And I'm invariably surprised by it in one way or another. It's never quite exactly what I'm expecting, and usually surprised for the worse, I must say. And I'm wondering if you've seen patterns in some of the big names that are invariably invoked are Hannity and Limbaugh, Beck, O'Reilly, the national figures, Michael Savage. The tenor of these programs changed in the last 5 years, or is it pretty much the same, or 10 years? I mean, or is it pretty much the same shtick for as long as they've been in action?
You know, most of the main characters, now, somebody who does kind of keep ratcheting it up ever nastier and ever farther is Ann Coulter. Now, Limbaugh and O'Reilly, you know, honestly, they're doing what they've been doing for much of the past 8 years, although O'Reilly definitely stepped it up recently in the last couple of years of his jihad against Dr. Tiller, which we saw the fruition of very recently. The one person that strikes me as being is representing a real sort of turning point in this is Glenn Beck. Mm-hmm. And just since this has really changed mostly since he went to Fox. He wasn't so bad on CNN, although he did a lot of conspiratorial stuff even on CNN. I mean, I remember watching one of his episodes there where they were, he and his guest were basically saying that Ahmadinejad was the Antichrist and that the apocalypse is coming out of Iran. And he does the apocalyptic stuff all the time. But more than that, what I'm seeing now from Glenn Beck, for the first time, material that I saw strictly relegated to the far right, to the Patriot right in the 1990s, actually being broadcast straight up for mainstream consumption. This includes his theories about the Federal Reserve, which I should point out aren't significantly different than what James von Braun's attitudes about the Federal Reserve were, which was basically it was a secret cabal that's been destroying America. As well as he's been trotting out, you know, he did the FEMA concentration camps thing. Now, he did do an episode where he actually debunked the FEMA concentration camps, but it was something akin to running the correction on A26 after running banner page or three banner page stories in a row on A1. And because he had been spending the month prior to this episode talking about how I can't disprove these FEMA concentration camps. We've looked into it, and I can't disprove it. You know, and of course, I posted at my blog that if somebody told me that that he engaged in obscene acts with somebody else, would I want to go on the air and say somebody told me this, but I can't disprove it? You know, it's the same sort of journalistic standard. It's just incredible that they allow somebody like that on the air. But even more than that, it's there is a real profound ethical component to this. You need to understand that people like Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh are also viewed as liberal by extremists like James von Braun and other or Scott Roeder. So when they're viewed as the mainstream liberal media, you know, because they actually do see themselves outside of the sort of mainframe of society. And so when they hear people like O'Reilly and Beck broadcast their beliefs as verifiable fact on TV, on mainstream media, that does two really powerful things. First, it totally validates their beliefs. It tells them, boy, I was right on the money all along. And not only that, it gives them permission to act. It gives them permission to act on these beliefs because it's telling them, as eliminationist rhetoric has always done, that the rest of society is behind you. And this is an important part of the sort of dynamic of hate crime, sort of on a micro level, that when people who commit hate crimes often believe that they are acting on the secret wishes of their community, the sort of unspoken wishes of their community when they act these things out. And this is why it's so critical for communities to do the sort of ritual standing up to bias crimes and hate speech when they occur within their communities. I know they have kind of a PC quality to them, but the sort of not-in-our-town response to this sort of behavior is incredibly powerful because it knocks this plank up from under them, this belief that, well, we're really doing what the community secretly wants. And I think on a national scale, that's what we need to be talking about doing as well.
You know, if I can say, David Nyward, I've followed the George Tiller case a bit, not closely, but closely enough that I was familiar that Bill O'Reilly had mentioned Dr. Tiller more than a few times in his program. And I see today in Frank Rich's column in the New York Times, it was 29 times, if I'm not mistaken.
29 times. And he called him a baby killer or baby murderer or mass murderer, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and Eric Bollard's column, I think, had quotes, too, that were extraordinary. And
yeah.
I'm just curious, I have not watched O'Reilly since the Tiller assassination. How has Bill O'Reilly reconciled his behavior with the murder of Dr. Tiller?
He's gone on the offensive. He's basically said that the people who are saying this are trying to silence me and trying to shut me up and that sort of thing. And, you know, of course, the response is that, no, we're not trying to shut you up. We're not trying to silence you, Bill. We want you to use your incredibly powerful free speech rights responsibly, We want you to use that incredible power of the millions of people you reach with your massive media megaphone, which is not a right. That is a privilege. But we want you to use that your free speech rights expressed through that media megaphone with some responsibility for a change. This is incredibly irresponsible rhetoric. But unfortunately, what he's done is he's got on the offense, has attacked the people who criticized him. He's been incredibly disingenuous about what he said. I mean, he's gone on the air and said, "Well, I'm just reporting what other people said about Dr. Tiller," and that's just a flat-out lie. He called him Tiller the baby killer on numerous occasions, and there was absolutely no reference to anybody else's reference to him as that. That was O'Reilly's name for him. And so he's lied about it. He's been incredibly defensive. And yet what he has never done in this entire time is acknowledge any regret that this man was dead, any feeling of remorse for having potentially inspired a murder. And that, to me, speaks in many more volumes about Bill O'Reilly than anything else he could say. That his complete remorselessness is really striking to me.
Our guest today on Media Matters, David Nywert, who you've just been listening to, author of the brand new book, The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, available in fine bookstores and I trust online. For anyone so interested, we're taking calls today. It's a live program. The number here at WILL AM 580-333-9455. The toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Oftentimes, David Nywert, when we talk about right-wing media, we talk about the cable TV celebrities that we've been dealing with, O'Reilly, Beck, Hannity, Ann Coulter, or the radio version of it, and Savage and Limbaugh. But it goes far beyond that, doesn't it? I mean, sometimes I'm driving around the country, different parts, and I'll turn on AM radio, and it seems like there are sort of local versions oftentimes of these guys as well.
Yeah. Well, there are a million little clones out there. Limbaugh clones. Yeah, actually, if you drive out in the rural West or rural Midwest much, it's hard to find anything but either Limbaugh or Savage or the local clones on the air. That and a little good country music. So, yeah, I wind up listening to good country music a lot.
Well, how does that happen in terms of the market? I thought, you know, these people that represent political views that are not a majority of the population, even in the Mountain West.
Right.
Or at least if they are, the people aren't showing up to vote then on Election Day. They're a minority, and they're a distinct minority in large parts of the country, yet they seem to be overwhelming on AM talk radio. What's the story there?
Ownership. I think you and I both know that ownership basically dictates the direction a station takes. And with the lack of a fairness doctrine, owners can basically make their radio skew any way they want. And the reality is that the vast majority of radio station owners out there are pretty right-wing.
But they do want to make money, don't they? And if you know, they wouldn't put something that's going to sort of cost them a huge amount of the market, would they?
Well, yeah, this is the astonishing thing to me. Look, I live here in Seattle, which is one of the more liberal cities in the country. We have three right-wing radio talk stations, one liberal progressive talk station, and it just runs canned stuff off of Air America. We do have easily the most popular local station, it must be said, is the NPR station here locally, KUOW. But, and then we have a one supposedly middle-of-the-road station that features one centrist and one famous and one extreme right-winger and then no liberals. So, it's just amazing to me the way that the ownership has skewed the market, even in places like Seattle, where you would think that, yeah, they would be smart and try to pander to the ideological skew of the market here. But instead, what we've got is this really distorted version of the marketplace. And to me, it tells me that, I don't understand how these guys make money, frankly. but they do, but not very well. At least two of the three right-wing talk stations are not doing well financially.
Our guest today, David Nywert. Let's go to the phone lines right now. David Nywert, the author of the brand new book, The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580, based in Urbana. Now let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with David Nywert.
Hi. I have about 1.5 comments, and I'll take off the air to listen after that. Firstly, I'd like to thank WILL for holding this sort of discussion. It's important to name something when it's happening, and it's become more and more socially unacceptable to talk about this sort of thing as if we're just kind of supposed to accept it in the name of, you know, just a balance of everybody's expression of all of their political views and everything. And the way that the gentleman today is talking about it. There's been a radicalization on the right, and my comment was just that maybe you could speak about how it makes the discourse, not just for the right, but for the whole country, it brings it very far to the right, so that if you want to say something and you have recourse to this idea of balance, you're still moving to the right because of how far the right has brought it to the right, so that you get moderate people, for like President Obama, for instance, and they're being claimed to be very radically leftist, and so they've succeeded in bringing the discourse part of the right. Even if you're just trying to be a middle of the road person, you're on the right even further. So, if that makes any sense, I wonder if you could discuss that a little bit. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, caller David Nywert.
Yeah, well, he's absolutely right. I mean, for one thing, I'll just use myself as an example. Now, I'm a guy who was raised in southern Idaho in a Goldwater Republican family, and I still hunt and fish. I was pretty darn conservative most of my upbringing. I'm still not very leftist. But, you know, I basically embrace the label of being a liberal because it's been largely forced on me by conservatives who see anybody who is not conservative as a liberal. Or even more to the point, movement conservatives who basically are more interested in casting heretics out of their movement than in actually embracing real principles of actual conservatism. And it's one of the kind of points that I make in the book. I don't expect to be reaching a lot of conservatives with this book, but it is important to understand that I think conservatism is a very important part of having a healthy body politic. And I think if I were a true conservative, I would be very concerned about the nature of movement conservatism as opposed to what conservatism really is all about, because movement conservatism is sort of metastasized into this beast that is only sort of in name conservative in any real meaningful sense. In the most real sense, it's actually fairly radical.
Well, you know, let me stop you there, Dave, now, because this is something I wanted to ask you about. As I looked at James von Brunn and this dude who killed Dr. Tiller, and listen to these shows, I'm trying to get a sense of what the political agenda of this type of conservatism is. What is the values, the principles, the program? And because I know when someone tells me about Barry Goldwater or Ronald Reagan, I have a sense of what they stood for, what their criticism was, whether you liked it or not, at least you knew what it was. I don't really know what these guys stand for exactly, except racism and hate. But, I mean, I really don't know what their program is.
Well, especially as it becomes more of a populist movement, and that's certainly what we're seeing evolving as these tea parties erupt, and Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin sort of become the leading figures of movement conservatism. It's what it ultimately is about is naked populist appeals designed to help them obtain power. I mean, ultimately, this is about the acquisition of power by any means necessary.
And let me ask you another issue that seems to come up all the time that relates to what the caller asked you about, which is you'll hear people say, well, you know, you have lunatics on the right and you got the same type of people over there on the left who are doing the same sort of stuff. And so, you know, it's just you have these extreme wackos at both ends, and we don't have to, you know, they balance each other out more or
right.
less. Or it's nothing that should be associated with the political right. It's just extremists in general. Is there a left comparison in the United States to the person who killed Dr. Tiller or the guy who went to the Holocaust Museum? Is there the left equivalent in radio and television to announcers like Glenn Beck or Michael Savage or Rush Limbaugh?
No, and that is the difference. You know, we do hear some hateful rhetoric coming out of the left, particularly if you go into blog comments or sort of you know stuff that's coming from out of the fringes. And it's important to say that this stuff is wrong too. But I'll point out a couple of differences. Most of this talk is coming from people on the fringe. It's not coming from people with megaphones with millions of listeners. You know, you can just imagine the outrage that would happen if somebody on the left were to say something comparable to Michael Savage's remark that the tsunami disaster of December 2005 was in fact not a tragedy, which is what he said. You know, and the reason, of course, that he said that it wasn't a tragedy was because it was just millions of Muslims who hated America anyway, who died. And, you know, that kind of stuff is just so morally reprehensible that it's just astonishing to me that these people are still on the air and that they're still being given millions of dollars by advertisers to be on the air. And it's just, it's still difficult for me to imagine why anybody would have Ann Coulter back on their TV show after she makes a remark like, well, Timothy McVeigh, the only thing I regret about Timothy McVeigh was that he didn't take his truck bomb to the New York Times building. You know, that stuff's just so beyond the pale, so reprehensible that I can't believe that these people still get the sort of treatment that they do. And
I recall that after the Holocaust Museum murder event last week took place, that the following day, I believe it was Rush Limbaugh, who rejected the idea that this was an act of the extreme right, and I think characterized von Bruen as a leftist.
And Jonah Goldberg and Glenn Beck were doing that Friday too. So.
And I'm what is the criteria by which von Bruen become a leftist?
Well, they cherry-picked a few facts about him. You know, that he also hated the neocons because they were Jewish. And so he was going to maybe target that Weekly Standard building. That he also hated Bush. And that he, let's see, and there were, you know, a few other little nuggets that they were able to pull up. Most of it is coming out of that area of the conspiracist right that also does tread into the conspiracist left. But I did want to point out a sort of second difference between the angry left and the angry right. The angry left, when they get angry, they tend to target individuals. You know, they're mad at Dick Cheney, they're mad at George Bush, they're mad at Rumsfeld, anybody, you know, or even individual of these talk show figures. And when you hear the ugly rhetoric, it tends to be, you know, that they wish harm upon any of these individuals. One of the distinctive qualities of eliminationist rhetoric is that it is directed not just at individuals, but entire blocks of people. And so we have people on the right saying that they want to deport every one of the 12 million illegal immigrants here in the country. You hear Rush Limbaugh joke about how, oh, we shouldn't just do away with all the liberals. We want to keep a few of them around for museum pieces. And, making these kinds of sick jokes. And they're only funny, I might add, if you actually believe these things to begin with. you know, if you actually harbor a wish to do away with all liberals. And we hear it a lot in the sort of angry rhetoric that gets run out on a daily basis. And you can find it in, I mean, just read Jim David Adkisson's manifesto that he left in that Knoxville Unitarian Church, or out in the seat of his car after he went in and shot up that Knoxville Unitarian Church last July. It was a long manifesto that basically concluded, kill all liberals. You can buy liberal hunting stickers out there on right-wing sites and liberal hunting permits.
You know, before we get to the next caller, I just want to, this point I wanted to get to after the next caller, but I'll do it now since you've raised it. Mm-hmm. Shepard Smith, I saw a clip of him, the newscaster on, I think it's Smith. Shepard Smith on Fox.
Mm-hmm. Was, talking, you know, about the hateful stuff.
Yeah, you know, he's getting these pile of emails. He's a Fox announcer. And, you know, he's noting that the anger and threat of violence and the sort of, you know, real hatred of the Obama administration and the current government of the United States is dramatically more frightening to him than it was even 5 months ago. That, you know, he's noticing a huge difference in the hundreds of emails he's getting at the station. And it seems this is a piece of what you're talking about.
Yeah, it is getting a lot worse. Part of what I, you know, I was just at the I attended the Reform Immigration Summit in Washington, D.C., which is, so on Saturday, I actually went and visited the Holocaust Museum and had spent the day in there. They have a terrific new display on Nazi propaganda that, you know, if you have time, anybody's in D.C., go visit this. It's absolutely worth seeing. But I also spent some time with the Reform Immigration Summit the week before, and I was trying to tell folks at this summit that the chatter we're seeing from the extremist right is uglier and more violent and more frenzied than anything I can, in my memory, have seen it. They are really getting worked up, and they're really getting angry and violent, and they want, some of these people really want civil war.
Is this, I'm just speculating here, I could be completely wrong, but is this to some extent because the movement or the broader politics have been repudiated? They feel more marginalized and more cornered?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of it has to do with their powerlessness and impotence. And I think that that's actually part of why Beck and O'Reilly are stepping up the rhetoric, too. I think that they understand that they're politically impotent right now, and this is their way of striking back.
But if the Republican Party embraces that, then don't they, how many elections can you win if that's your base?
I don't think very many. I think it's going to make it's going to just enhance their downward spiral. And eventually, what's going to happen, of course, is even the Becks and the and O'Reillys are going to lose their lofty ratings, because even a lot of their fellow Kool-Aid drinkers are going to stop drinking the Kool-Aid, especially from as things become more and more violent and more radical. Nonetheless, they are in the clutches of it, and they are not letting go. I mean, we can see that just in the fact that O'Reilly was absolutely unreflective, unrepentant, and utterly remorseless about the death of Dr. Tiller.
Let's go back to our phone lines now to a couple of callers who have been waiting very patiently to speak with our guest, David Nywert, the author of the brand new book, The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. Let's now go to line 2 on a cell phone. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Nywert. I think we lost.
We must have lost him.
I think we did, and I apologize to that caller. If they call back, I will get you on. Let's instead go to our next caller, the toll-free lines, Cincinnati, Ohio, on line 4. You're on the air with David Nywert.
Yes, I heard mention of the right-wing ideas or attitudes that were involved in Clinton's impeachment. I wondered what those are. And the other question would be, is PETA a left wing or are they a right wing group? Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
PETA is very much a left wing group.
And PETA, for the sake of listeners who might not be familiar with it, is?
The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Okay.
And they are, they're a left-wing group. What's notable, of course, about PETA, and not just PETA, but also some of the left-wing eco-terrorists is that they target property. They don't target people. I don't think they've killed anybody, unlike, say, Timothy McVeigh or the man or James von Braun or Scott Roeder. All those people actually target people and commit acts of murder, which is a significant level up from as an act of terrorism, in my mind, from property damage. And secondarily, there's the volume of right-wing extremist terrorist acts is exponentially greater on the right than it is on the left.
So what about then the first part of the call, the Clinton, what were some of the memes of 1998 that the Republicans were channeling that had grown out of the ultra-far violent right?
Well, some of this had to do with Clinton and the New World Order and the claims that he was part of the New World Order. But there were bizarre claims about Clinton that came out of the conspiracist right, particularly the whole theory that he was running drugs out of MENA, Arkansas, that he was part of this conspiratorial cabal to commit a variety of crimes. My favorite was the Clinton body count, which was actually invented by a militia woman named Linda Thompson. She actually created the first iteration of it. Bob, did you ever get one of these in your email inbox?
Probably not. Or if I did, it probably got deleted.
Right. Most people did get these back in the 90s. It was the list of people who, and in some counts I saw up to 120 different people who Clinton was responsible for the death of. beginning, of course, with Vince Foster. And, you know, it started out, I think, on Linda Thompson's list. She invented this thing. She's the militia woman who, back in the 90s, tried to get a militia march on Washington going, and it kind of fell flat. And she's also the person, I should add, who's responsible for many of those FEMA concentration camp videos that you see floating around even today, which actually were just trains or video of empty train depots, abandoned train depots. But and that's fairly typical of Linda Thompson. She was a total nutcase, even to the point that Bo Greitz wanted nothing to do with her, which tells you something. And but nonetheless, she came up with this Clinton body count. Well, it became I saw Babe Buchanan talking and Barbara Olson talking about the Clinton body count on MSNBC back in 98.
You know, let me ask you another question that follows up on a lot of what we're talking about. Oftentimes for the last 10 or 15 years, programs like this and discussion in the mainstream has talked about the Christian right and the important role it plays in the Republican Party and in getting conservatives elected. What is the relationship of the Christian right to the sort of stuff we're talking about?
Well, it plays a significant role in terms of sort of spreading a lot of the, there's a lot of dualism in the Christian right, particularly as it becomes more and more, far right evangelically. Now, it is important to understand that a lot of the patriot movement beliefs were actually gurgled up out of a movement we call Christian identity. And Christian identity was basically white supremacy as a religion, and it's still floating around out there. Now, I don't equate Christian identity with the evangelical right, but there definitely has been some bleed over. And in particular, there's been a great deal of anti-Semitism floating up from the sort of very arch-conservative corners of the religious world, and the most prominent one being, you know, Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, which mm-hmm. is a profoundly anti-Semitic movie, and its avid support among sort of the evangelicals. But there was also a great deal of sort of cross-hatching between evangelical believers during the 1990s, and it continued into the past decade. Involving this whole thing with the New World Order conspiracy theories. You may recall that Pat Robertson actually wrote a book titled The New World Order, and it basically was a regurgitation of a lot of these Protocols of Seven Elders of Zion-derived conspiracy theories about international banks and the Fed secretly running America. This is the same sort of thing that James von Brunn believed when he went on into the Fed back in 1981 and tried to arrest Paul Volcker. But these sorts of things are, you know, we do see a lot of cross-hatching, and a lot of the sort of uglier tendencies of the mainstream right that we saw happening in the past decade were very closely related to evangelical beliefs, particularly the treatment of the vicious fight against gays and lesbians and the fight over gay marriage, as well as, I might add, the just the general tendency during the Iraq War and the run-up to the Iraq invasion and the general post-9/11 mentality that we all thought George Bush was just a wonderful guy because and any criticism of him became treasonous. And that's where I think, and there was a lot of that on the evangelical right, the sort of treatment of dissent as treason.
Well, let's go, if we can, right now, David Nywert, to our final caller. Let's go to line one, Chicago. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Nywert.
Thank you. Maybe in a lighter note, in one way, but serious in another sense, overseas, we ought to have a group for the people for the ethical treatment of comics, how they treat celebrities. Apparently, some people are more sensitive than others, depending on how... they're characterized, but the David Letterman characterization of Sarah Palin recently has gotten a lot of play. But then in this country, we have the freedom, as it were, to say things without appearing hateful, but sarcastic and certainly degrading, depending on how you're looking at it. And overseas, we have any characterization, say, of the Islamic faith, people responding in a deadly manner. So could you make your sort of a general comment on how you view those matters. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. David Nywert?
Can you kind of, I'm not sure I caught the
well, I guess
question
if, there. Let me paraphrase it or rephrase it for the caller. You know, what does it mean that you have this Holocaust attack and this sort of this rapid increase of threat of violence from not just the far political right, but elements of what would be considered the heart and soul of the Republican Party. I mean, O'Reilly certainly would be considered way to the right, or Glenn Beck even. I mean, he's comfortable with the mainstream Republicans, it seems like, in many respects. That this is taking place at the same time as there's a huge uproar and flap over David Letterman's comic monologue about Sarah Palin.
Sure. Well, you know, we call that projection. Projection is not just for theaters anymore. A lot of times, well, look, I mean, we've got them constantly calling, thanks to Jonah Goldberg, we've got them calling President Obama and the Democrats in Congress liberal fascists. I mean, they're calling them fascists. And, of course, I've done quite a bit of work trying to debunk Goldberg's execrable work. But nonetheless, you know, you've got it being repeated on a pretty constant basis. I've done a lot of radio shows the last week or so, and I can tell you that I've gotten a number of callers coming in and saying, well, when you talk about fascism, you're talking about a left-wing phenomenon. And I'm like, oh, another Goldberg reader, you know, and what can you do? This stuff is spreading. It's so blatantly false. It's not as bad as Holocaust denial, but it's right up there as far as I'm concerned.
You know, something that I want to ask you about before the program ends, it's something that I think occurs to a lot of people, but it's almost never spoken about. You know, had the guy who went into the Holocaust Museum been a Muslim or an Arab American or a person of an Arab descent, or had Dr. Tiller or whatever reason, had a doctor been murdered by, you know, a Muslim for whatever reason, but especially the Holocaust story. I mean, you know, the response would have been completely different, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, obviously. And in sort of conversely, remember the case of the New York terrorists a few weeks ago, the black guys who were supposedly caught plotting some nefarious event. Mostly they were entrapped by an informer, it appears. But up there in the Bronx, the black guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I pointed out at crooksandlawyers.com, you know, well, what if these guys had been white? What if, would they, how would this have been treated? And I would argue it would have been buried just like the six Alabama militiamen back last year who were busted for planning to go on a killing rampage against a bunch of Latinos who lived nearby down in Alabama. You know, that story got completely buried. Similar cases. So, yeah, I think, you know, the Holocaust Museum case was just right there in the nation's face, and I think people couldn't miss it. But we do have a real propensity to overlook acts of terrorism when it comes from white domestic actors, and way overplay it when it comes from Muslims, particularly even including Muslim converts. I mean, the Bronx case was very similar to the one with down in Florida, the Liberty 7 case, and that case went before two different juries, and they were acquitted both times because it was such a clear case of entrapment. And yet, I remember at the time, the whole Liberty 7 thing dominated headlines for at least a couple of days in the news cycle. You know, so I think it's... I think it's kind of ridiculous that we do get an overemphasis on the supposed hate speech from the left. For, you know, David Letterman is not really a serious figure on the left. B, he's a comedian, and he made a bad taste joke that's, you know, whatever. And finally, what he said wasn't that outrageous compared to, you know, calling somebody a baby killer 29 times.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, going on to your theme about the sort of the far right as being legitimated within the Republican Party, one of the things that was striking to me, and I think to a lot of people watching last year's presidential campaign, was that the tenor of the mood at the McCain rallies was, you know, the joke was that someone went to a Klan rally and a McCain meeting broke out, or because it was so extraordinarily right wing. And was that, is that an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that
to the extent you agree with that, I mean, you might disagree. I don't know.
No, I would agree with that. And you know, look, I also don't want to play down the case of the Muslim man who did gun down the military recruiter in Arkansas. This is clearly a case also of somebody who was acting on sort of lone wolf theory. And it's interesting, lone wolf theory originated with Louis Beam back in 1998, but we saw some intelligence indicating back in 2003 that Al-Qaeda had actually picked up this theory from Louis Beam and was instituting it on sort of a local level, that they were working to try to train lone wolves and small cells as well, leaderless resistance. And so we have seen some of that. And I don't want to, I think it's important not to minimize that as well. But what we really face is a very serious issue going forward with some very violent actors out there. We need to be prepared for it law enforcement-wise, but we also need to be prepared for it socially. We need to be prepared to start standing up to this stuff, because the only way we're going to start turning the temperature down on the rhetoric that's inspiring these kinds of acts is to go to the people who are turning the temperature up and start standing up to them and saying, Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, you can't do this anymore.
But the people who are going to say that to those guys don't listen to their shows.
Well, they actually do.
Oh.
You know, that's the problem. I mean, everybody thinks that, yeah, they don't consider them credible. They consider them the liberal media. But these people consume mainstream media just like the rest of us.
No, but I'm sorry.
They have Fox News on their TVs at home.
This is such a great point, Dave Nyward. I'd love to talk about it. Unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they're trying to clear me out of the studio. David Nyward, the author of The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. Thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Hey, Bob, I really appreciate it.
Well, good luck with the book. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for working the board, Andrew Boyle for being my producer. Got a lot of great shows lined up in the next few weeks with Barbara Ehrenreich, Naomi Klein, Susan Lynn, and Janine Jackson. So Be sure to tune in, and everyone have a great week. See you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today we'll see partly sunny skies with a high of 79 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 59. Monday.